This is Shamir Young, bringing you the Pro Photographer Journey Podcast. Listen in as award-winning photographers discuss how they find opportunities, market their talent, and overcome mistakes to become respected, ever-advancing professional creatives. You'll also hear about their hard-learned lessons, as well as tips for making awesome images. You ready to take your photography business to the next level? Let's do it. And if you haven't already, be sure to pick up your free photography business bundle at prophotographerjourney.com/freebusinessbundle. It's 4 weeks of helpful free gifts delivered every 7 days directly to your email inbox. The first thing you'll get is the PDF e-guide titled 12 Common Business Tips and Mistakes Photographers Wish They'd Known Before Going Pro. And believe me, I've made quite a few of these mistakes myself. After that, you'll get a new free gift every week that will help you propel your photography business forward. So head on over to prophotographerjourney.com/freebusinessbundle and get yours today. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a review in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you're listening. The more reviews I get, the easier it is for people to find this podcast in search rankings. And I want to reach as many people as possible. So again, please leave a review. I really appreciate it. Quick update, guys. You may have noticed the name of this podcast has slightly changed since the last episode. It was previously called the Pro Photographer Interview Series. It's now called the Pro Photographer Journey. I've also updated the website for this podcast. It used to live on Zenjoyable.com and actually started off as a side project on that site. However, over time, this podcast has grown into its own thing, so I wanted to move it and give it its own home. You will now find this podcast on its very own domain at prophotographerjourney.com. Again, that's prophotographerjourney.com. I think these changes more accurately reflect the subject matter of this podcast, and I've made some other changes too, mainly in how I operate the podcast behind the scenes. You may have noticed that it's been 6 months since I've published a new episode, which is way too long. I used to record these one at a time and post them when I could, but then I got busy, life got in the way, you know the common reasons. So now I'm recording these episodes in batches, and I'm actually scheduling them to go out in advance, which is what I should have been doing in the first place. I'm excited to say I have about 6 months of episodes already lined up and ready to go for you guys. Now, in my discussions with these awesome photographers and experts, we tend to cover a lot of information in the interviews. So after every interview episode I release, I have also recorded a short solo action guide episode in which I extract and discuss the most actionable advice from the previous episode's interview. This is to help you guys apply this info to your own photography businesses and to life. Okay, cool. Now that we've got that out of the way, let's get to the interview. Hey, everybody. I'm hanging with Gary Arndt, world traveler and photography nomad. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, I'm so excited to talk to you because it looks like you've had quite a few experiences around the world with your photography. And, you know, first of all, I'd like us to get to know you better, our listening audience. So just give us an overview of yourself, your background, and what you like to do.
Well, I started a very early internet company back in 1994, and I sold that in 1998. And after that, I started a couple other companies. I went back to school for a couple years. I studied geology and geophysics. And I kind of reached a point in my life where I didn't know what I wanted to do anymore. And I realized I love traveling. So I made the decision that I was going to travel around the world for a year or two. So in 2007, I sold my house and I set out to travel around the world. And that 1 or 2 years has kind of turned into 8. And during that time, when I started, I knew nothing about photography. I mean, literally nothing about photography. I often say I couldn't tell you the difference between my aperture and my ISO. And I bought, like a lot of people, I bought a camera that was way over my head. I didn't know how to use it. I was shooting in automatic, shooting in JPEG, and I took a lot of bad photos. Hmm. A lot of bad photos. And thankfully, I at least was able to recognize that the photos were bad. And I just slowly kind of got better. I would, you know, go in and research something online. You know, what is aperture? Why should I do this? And just, and kind of piecemeal began improving what I was doing. And today it's probably what I'm best known for.
And you know, I think a lot of our beginning listeners, who are beginners to photography would find that encouraging that you didn't know anything about your camera at all when you first started. I think that's awesome.
Well, you know, the basics of what you do in terms of exposure, in terms of the settings on your camera, are not necessarily that hard. There's only a few, and it's just a matter of practicing until you get an intuitive feel for what your look, what the scene is you're shooting, and what the settings on your camera should be. Mm-hmm. And that took, I don't know, maybe a year or two. And then it really became more an issue of, you know, composition, which I think, you know, you're always working on, and just knowing what to shoot and observing the right things. And that's something that you always, you know, I think are working on.
Absolutely. I remember being in college and I had some photography instruction there, but let me tell you, probably 98% of what I've learned has been out in the field, dealing with people and developing the photographer's eye.
Yeah, I've met some people that have, you know, gotten degrees in photography, and I don't know what to say. I'm just like, well, I just kind of did it. I think it's very different today. I know a lot of people, when they got degrees in photography, were dealing with film and dark rooms. And I think that's much more difficult. Whereas if you're working with digital photography and, say, editing in Lightroom, I think there's less to it. It's certainly less time consuming than dealing with everything in a dark room. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably a little bit easier. And if you're technically inclined, I think it's also a bit easier as well.
Very true. Yeah. And you do get that instant gratification as well. As soon as you take the photo, you get to see what you did.
Yeah. And I've never shot with film.
You know, I haven't either, actually.
And I have no desire to.
Yeah.
And I know there are these people, it's like, oh, well, you know, and as if it's some sort of spiritual experience. It's like, no, this is the tool I use, and I'm comfortable using it. And, you know, realistically, if I shot film, I would be doing it as a gimmick or just for fun. I wouldn't, you know, it would never be a real part of my workflow.
Absolutely. And also, I have to ask, now you mentioned that you sold a business way back before you started traveling. What was that business in general, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, not at all. So my college, I don't know if you've heard of a product called Cold Fusion.
Yes.
So my college roommate wrote it.
Oh.
And he wrote it while we were living together after school. And in the early days, he had some companies that were coming to him saying, we would like to make a website using your product. Because at the time, so this is in like 94, the only way to hook up a database to a website, you had to use an Oracle server or a database. You had Sun servers and Perl scripting. There was no PHP. There really wasn't any Linux at that point. And so what he did is he created a product that let you hook up a database using HTML-like tags, and it would run on Windows NT, which was Microsoft's new serving software, serving operating system. And it was a low-cost alternative to what you had at the time. And back then, you know, most people didn't even use a database, even though today everything we do is on a database, if you use WordPress or something like that. But back then, it was still rather uncommon. So I began using Cold Fusion to make data-driven websites for some newspapers, brokerage firms, things like that. And eventually then we started using active server pages for Microsoft. So we built these custom websites. And in 4 years, I went from doing it myself, kind of freelancing, to having a company of 50 people. And then I sold it.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So I'm curious then, that the website experience that you have from years ago, does that help you with what you're doing today in your website?
To an extent. I very quickly stopped doing web development when I had my company, because I hired other people to do it. So I know enough to be dangerous. I can look at, you know, PHP and whatnot and understand what it's doing, but I don't actually do most of the web development. In fact, I'm about to launch a brand new website this week. I haven't updated my website in 6 years, but I have a developer that's doing that. I think the business experience has helped more than anything else. Thinking, and that's true of, I think, a lot of photographers. You know, there are photographers out there who may have a good eye and take good photos, but it doesn't mean that they're going to be able to make a business out of their photography because they simply lack the business skills.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, I think that's something, well, back to my college days, which I loved my college, by the way, and you know, my university, but there was a distinct lack of business training that they gave us. And again, I think a lot of that with anything comes to your experiences outside of the classroom in the real world. And I know some absolutely awesome creatives, artists, photographers who create work where I look at it and I'm like, wow, that is so far beyond me. But at the same time, they struggle getting their work out there as well as turning it into a business. And I think that's really what helps some people, and it's also what holds some people back.
Well, with what I do, it's so inextricably bound up into the travel. And I tell people, I'm a traveler first and a photographer second.
Mm.
So if I had to choose, if a genie came out and said, you could be the world's greatest wedding photographer or the world's greatest glamour shots photographer, but you could never travel, or you can travel the rest of your life, but you can't carry a camera, I'd probably throw the camera away.
Okay.
And I think, you know, you hear it a lot that you really have to be passionate about the subject, whatever it is, that you're photographing. And I think it's because I view myself as a traveler first that I'm able to find some success in the world of travel photography.
And, you know, that really takes us to the next question that I was going to ask you. Tell us about the area of photography that you would call your expertise then.
I'm a travel photographer. And that my definition of travel photography is quite broad. To me, it's anything that is not done in a studio or some sort of controlled shoot. It's basically going out and shooting the world on its own terms. So that includes street photography. It includes landscape photography. It includes wildlife photography, you know, almost anything. And people say, well, you know, if I photograph my child's birthday party, is that travel photography? Well, people don't think of it as such. But if you were shooting a birthday party for someone you met in China or Africa, you would think of it as travel photography because you think of it as being exotic or different, but it's really kind of the same.
Interesting. And previously you mentioned that you have to be passionate about what you're shooting. So tell us, how do you get yourself inspired for a photo shoot or when you're going to a new city or a new country?
I don't consider what I do a photo shoot, really. Mm-hmm. I will often just go out with my camera and just wander around. I don't think it's a matter of being inspired. I think when you visit a new place, you have all the inspiration you need. The fact that you're in a foreign environment, you don't know where everything is. You may not know, probably don't know the language. There's plenty to see and take in and observe. And that is pretty easy to do. I think if I was a wedding photographer when I was doing my 5,000th wedding, that would be something I would need to find inspiration for. But travel is pretty easy.
Excellent. Now tell us, in your opinion, what makes a good photo stand out from an average photo?
That's hard to say. You know, one of the things that I've noticed, because I post a lot of my stuff on social media and I have a good-sized social media following, I will often post things that I think are great photos and they bomb. And people just, and I'm like, why didn't you like this? This is a great photo. I really like this photo. And then there are other times where I post something that's like, I need to put something up today. Okay, I'll do this one. It's fine. And it goes nuts. And so it's very difficult to understand what goes into a great photo and what doesn't. There are certain photos that I like, and I think some of them may have to do that I understand the backstory behind it.
Mm.
Whereas someone who looks at the photo, unless I put a pretty in-depth caption, they're not going to understand the backstory behind it. And the photo becomes more interesting when you for example, I was on the island of Samoa, or the country of Samoa, a couple of years ago, and there are these things called blowholes. So the surf comes in under this rock, shoots up a hole, and it's like a cannon blast the way the water comes up, because there's all this pressure going up this very small hole. And there was this guy who lived near the blowhole, and what he would do is he would give him a couple dollars, and he would take coconuts and drop them into the blowhole. And he knew how to do it such he could time it such that when he dropped them in, they would shoot up like 100 feet in the air. And this was really neat. And so I have a photo of this blowhole going up, and there's a one pixel dot you can see. That's this coconut. And when I show people this photo, they're like, yeah, okay. And I say, that dot, that's a coconut. And they're like, really? And then when you explain it, then it becomes, you know, there's a lot more to it.
And, you know, I could totally see that with travel photography, as far as the narrative behind the photo and getting people to understand that. So then would you say that, and I think this is pretty much what you just said, but correct me if I'm wrong. So if your audience understands the story behind a photo, then they're able to connect with it in a greater way?
Sometimes.
Okay.
I think sometimes a photo is just cool. And you can, so for example, I was in Sierra Leone last year. I was taking a ship up the west coast of Africa from Cape Town to Morocco. And we had these dancers come on the ship, and one of them was a fire dancer. And I got, for 5 seconds, this dancer looked right at me, and he had two flaming sticks, one in his mouth, and one he was rubbing against his arm, and his eyes had this maniacal look for this 5 seconds he was staring at me, and it's just a great photo. And you don't really need a backstory to see that it was a neat photo. Mm-hmm. But then there are other photos that, you know, giving that background I just did, you know, kind of helps explain it, but you can kind of get it when you look at the photo. There's another one. I did an aerial flight scene tour over the Namib Desert out of the city of Swakopmund in Namibia. And there's this one particular dune called the Wall of Death. And it's this enormous dune that abuts the Atlantic Ocean. And it's 300 feet high. And it looks cool. People, you know, really respond well to the photo. But when you give them the detail of just how big it is and how it got the name the Wall of Death, because you can't drive along the bottom of the coast near that wall at high tide, otherwise you'll get stuck in the water. That can add a little bit to it, even though it's a neat photo.
I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bit jealous right now.
I get it a lot.
Oh, my goodness. Even looking at your site beforehand, I think it said you'd been to over 150, was it 170 countries?
Well, countries, how you define a country is actually not an easy question. So if you do it just by United Nations member states, I've been to 110 countries. Mm-hmm. But that does not include places like Antarctica, the Cook Islands. Like if I said, I am going to France, you are thinking, okay, that is the place in Europe where they wear berets and eat baguettes. But French Guiana, which is in South America, is just as much a part of France as Hawaii is a part of the United States.
Oh, that's so true. Yep.
They vote for president. They have representation in their parliament. That's a part of France. Same with French Polynesia. So, but it's not France, right? You know, it's not what we consider. We consider it a separate thing. So those places, different territories, Cook Islands, Puerto Rico, Gibraltar, things like that, if you start to add up different territories, and there's a list created by a group called the Traveler Century Club, I've been to 176 of those.
That is awesome. You know, later in the interview, I'm dying to ask you now, but I'm going to save it for later when we get to the business portion of the interview. I'm dying to know how you fund your travels. But I will ask that later. Next, let's move on to the tools of the trade. Can you tell us what your typical go-to gear is for your travels?
Sure. A lot of people are surprised at the gear I use. It's changed very little since the day I bought my camera. So when I bought the camera that I didn't know how to use, that was over my head, I bought a Nikon D200 and an 18 by 200 millimeter lens. It's the vibration reduction lens that they have. Mm-hmm. Today, I use the Nikon D300S, which is basically just the updated version of the D200, and I use the same lens. I also have a 50mm f1.4, I have a wide-angle 12-24, and then I have a Sigma 150-500 that I'll use for wildlife, and I don't carry that one around with me all the time, but I'm going to the Galapagos in September, and I'll bring that one with me there.
Awesome. And what's your favorite accessory, other than your camera, and tell us why?
Yeah, it'd probably be I have a small travel tripod. It's a carbon fiber one and a shutter release cable. I don't have a lot of accessories that I carry with me either. Okay. And a couple of filters. That's it. As far as photography accessories.
You know, for some people, it's like asking them to pick their favorite child as far as trying to pick your favorite accessory. Excellent.
Well, you know, there really is a lot of truth to the fact that you can go overboard with gear. The worst SLR you can buy is probably better than the best SLR that was available 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, if you think about it. So you can really do a lot of good things with, you know, moderate gear. And a lot of people I meet, they want to they upgrade their camera. And I ask them, well, what will this new camera do for you that your current one can't? And they don't have an answer to that question. They just feel if they spend more money, they'll get better pictures. Eventually, I'm going to probably get a full-frame camera, which I've been putting off for years, mainly out of laziness. But I know exactly what I'll be getting from it. I'll be getting better low-light capability, which is really important to me because I'm not using artificial lighting most of the time. Probably a more resolution with greater megapixel, which, again, I can find use for, and possibly a higher frame rate. Mm-hmm. And let me shoot faster, which is important when doing things like wildlife or other sort of action.
And, you know, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think it's really important to understand that, like you said, it's not the gear that necessarily makes your photos. It's your understanding of your subject matter, of composition, of light, of having an eye for a particular scene and capturing that, as opposed to spending thousands. You can easily spend thousands upon thousands of dollars trying to get the best camera or the best lens.
Once you have the basics, a decent body, a couple lenses, the best thing you can do if you want to be a travel photographer for your next $1,000 is buy a plane ticket. Then, you know, it's not a joke, because you have to be there. And trying to absolutely, you know, optimize and maximize your gear doesn't matter if you miss the great sunset or if you miss, you know, something that happens where you're just not there. And the reason I've had, I think, as much success as I've had as a travel photographer comes from the fact that I travel so much and I'm able to go to these places and be there. And there's just no replacement for that.
Absolutely. That is such a good point. Such a good point. Awesome. Now, let's quickly talk about your post-production workflow. I'm curious to know how you do this on the road. Can you describe what your workflow is like as far as any software that you like to use?
Pretty much I use Lightroom, and then I use SmugMug for my image hosting. Big fan of both. I've been using SmugMug for years. I think they're the best image hosting platform out there, and really enjoy it. And with Lightroom, yeah, I do the vast majority of my editing in Lightroom. Mm-hmm. I'd say 98%. There's a couple things I'll do in Photoshop, but most of it's just done straight in Lightroom.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Now, let's get to some of the specifics about running a photography business for yourself. And, you know, obviously this is, in your case, your travel photography business. What's the most challenging aspect of being in business for yourself? Because it sounds like you do this full time.
Yeah, now it's a full-time job. And, you know, my business is very different in that it's not a photography business per se. I'm not selling photos, and I'm not necessarily getting photography clients. What I do is use my photography to build a personal audience that I have on social media and my website. And then from there, I'm able to then get sponsors who want to sponsor me for my travels and other things in order to have access to that audience.
Okay, that's interesting. And you kind of beat me to the punch. That partially answers my next question about how you fund your travel. So you said you get sponsors.
I would say about half, maybe a little more than half of my travel, I just pay for out of pocket.
Okay.
The other part is I'm sent on trips by various destinations, tourism boards. They, you know, they've been doing that for decades. They bring out travel writers and such to help promote their destination. So that's something I do quite frequently. And then I have corporate sponsors as well. One of my sponsors is G Adventures. They're the world's biggest adventure travel company. I travel with them several times a year. So earlier this year, I went on their very first trip to Haiti, which was a really interesting experience. You know, Haiti is a place that's not far from the United States, yet they get almost no tourism. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to go to Haiti, whereas almost every other country in the Caribbean gets a fair amount of tourism. And so it was a very eye-opening experience going there. Last year, I went the trip up the west coast of Africa that I mentioned was with G Adventures. I've been to Antarctica with them. I think I've been to like 25 countries on trips with G Adventures so far.
And I'm recalling a photo from your website where you had, was it houses on the hillside of Haiti, I think? These beautiful, colorful dwelling spaces.
Yeah, that was actually, that's in Port-au-Prince. And it's actually my best performing photo ever on Instagram.
Really? Well, you know what? It caught my eye, obviously. It stands out in my mind.
Yeah, it's, you know, most of the hillside houses in Port-au-Prince are quite dull. They're like a gray. Mm-hmm. But that section, and I forget the name of the community, they decided to paint their houses in very bright colors. And if you look really close at the photo, you'll notice that, you know, they're not luxury houses. You know, they're primarily made of cinder block and, you know, a tin roof. That's mm-hmm. basically all it is. But they've kind of made it something distinctive. And yeah, it's a really interesting photo.
Yeah, and you know, I've seen photos of Haiti before. I've never been there. My husband has, and so he's come back with photos, and he's helped with some of the building of the rebuilding the structures after the earthquake there. But you know, I had not seen anything like the photo, and I'm looking at it right now on your homepage again from April that you posted. I mean, it's a really, really neat image, and once again, that proves your point that you really have to be there to take the photo, as opposed to spending all of your money on expensive gear and then not having the money to travel. Is getting to that destination and taking action, taking that photo.
Yeah, like I mentioned, my go-to lens is an 18 to 200, which I think is probably the best travel lens because it's so versatile. Mm-hmm. It's relatively wide and it has a relatively good zoom. It is, however, not the best lens. So if you were to run optical tests on it, I'm pretty sure it is not the best lens out there. That you could find prime lenses and whatnot that would outperform it at pretty much any zoom lens you want to pick. But it allows me to get to places more. It allows me to have one lens on my camera that I can go and pretty much shoot anything. And I believe that if you did have an optically superior lens, it's only going to be a little bit better. And it's not going to be that much noticeable in a photo.
Exactly.
So I don't think I'm losing that much because, yeah, it's all about being there. And you could think of pretty much any great photo in history. I'm thinking of famous photos from like World War II. There's that one where the sailor is kissing a woman in Times Square.
Yeah.
There's several from Vietnam that were quite famous. And those are all about being at the right place at the right time. In fact, some of those famous photos from Vietnam are kind of grainy, a little bit blurry. They weren't even focused properly. But what made them great photos is that it captured a moment in time, which was, you know, just remarkable. I think there's a photo from the Spanish Civil War that was taken in the 30s that showed a guy being shot and he's standing up and you can almost like it captured the bullet or part of the blood flying out of him. Hmm. And it wasn't a particularly, you know, technically a great photo. It's kind of blurry. It wasn't really shot well, but it captured a moment that, you know, really tells a pretty horrific story, and yep. it's being at the right place at the right time.
And so I'm curious what you think about this, and this isn't in the list of interview questions that I sent you beforehand, so kind of putting you on the spot, but which do you think is more important than the gear that you're using or the subject matter and being there at the right time?
Oh, being there. I've taken, you know, if you are witnessing history, something amazing, and even look on the news, When something happens, whether it's a natural disaster, a terrorist attack or something, people will take out their cell phones and they'll start recording.
Mm-hmm.
And those photos and that video which is taken is probably more, I mean, who cares if they don't have an SLR with some awesome lens, if the people that have that equipment aren't there. That, you know, you've probably heard the anecdote that the best camera is the one you have with you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that goes right back to the fact that you have to be there. And, you know, there's all kinds of examples of police abuse or other things which are now being captured because people have cameras with them.
Excellent. Oh, I like how you answered that with no hesitation right away.
Well, it's true. I mean, like I said, the worst camera you can buy, like go and try to purposely buy a crappy camera, is going to be an okay camera,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the big scheme of things, in the terms of history, which is why I don't think you should get too worked up on, you know, I get that question all the time. What camera should I get? Whatever camera you want. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, my only suggestion is get something that lets you manually change settings and shoots in RAW.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do those two things and I think you're fine.
That makes me feel better. I recently upgraded my camera after years of having the same one, and I basically outgrew my camera, which I think was a good thing, getting to the point where I knew I needed something better as opposed to wanting it out of vanity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of people want to have the best, you know, the top gear or something, but it's not that necessary.
Right. There's a lot of pressure out there, for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not impressing people with a camera around your neck. It's impressing people after the shots are taken.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people care about. You know, I have a lot of people that enjoy my images online. The vast majority do not ask or care about what camera I have.
Exactly. Now, Gary, tell us, I'm curious, what have you found to be the most effective techniques as far as growing your audience, marketing yourself, getting the word out there about these awesome photos that you take?
Be consistent. So I've been posting a photo on my website every day now for almost 8 years.
Wow.
Every single day, have not missed a single day. Even if I don't have internet access, I'll either schedule it ahead or I have an assistant who will post one of my photos for me. So every day, Instagram, I post a photo every day. I was kind of late to Instagram, but been doing okay since I've started taking it seriously, which is about a year now. So it's consistency, it's quality, and you know, a lot of that is being brutally honest with yourself. There's a temptation for people to think that your photos are somehow better than they are because they're your photos. And there are photos that I thought when I started were great, and I look back upon them now and they're just horrible. Mm-hmm. They're just cringeworthy. And so I think you really do need to be hard on yourself as far as what's a good photo.
And so does that involve getting a third party or a friend involved to help look at the photos with you? Or I guess, how do you get to the point where you can be so brutally honest with yourself with the photos that you've taken?
I think it's just something you have. I think the assumption needs to be that you suck.
Okay.
I mean, maybe you don't suck, but even if you're a great photographer, you constantly need to be looking for how you can improve. You have to have that mindset, because if you don't think you suck, you're going to become satisfied, and then then you don't improve. So you have to go in thinking. I mean, and I'll be honest, I do it all the time. People don't judge you on the photos you take; they judge you on the photos they see. And as any photographer will tell you, I mean, I know lots of great photographers that most of what they shoot, you know, maybe 90% of it, maybe more, the world never sees. Mm-hmm. So they don't see the bad stuff. They only see the good stuff.
Excellent. You know, next, let's talk about some lessons that you've learned over the years. What have you found? What is the most common mistake, in your opinion, that you see other professional travel photographers make or that you yourself have made?
I don't know if it's a mistake, but most of the travel photographers I see, especially online, tend to gravitate, at least at first, towards landscape photography. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with landscape photography. Most of what I shoot is still landscape photography. But I personally, I noticed that I was doing this. And also, I should note, on social media, people like landscape photography. If you post photos of sunsets and mountains and stuff, you know, waterfalls, rainbows, mountains, sunsets, they love that stuff. But I didn't want to just be known for that. So I had to make a conscious effort to start shooting more people. Okay. To try, you know, and that's a big part of travel photography. Even though there's a lot of travel photography, when you look at magazines and whatnot, they, I think, tend to go overboard in terms of, well, you know, if it's not a person from some exotic place wearing exotic clothing, that's not travel photography. Hmm. And so that it's a heavy emphasis on, especially, you know, India is a great example. There are so many photos of people from India, and they tend to be either very old people with very wrinkled skin or very young people, like children, wearing very colorful clothing. Or you'll see, I'm thinking of certain African tribes that have very distinctive forms of dress. Himba women in Namibia, forgetting the name of the tribe right now, they're in Kenya. They kind of wear blankets.
Okay.
It'll probably come to me right after the interview's done. But Buddhist monks, another really good example. Or you've probably seen photos from Papua New Guinea, and it's pretty much always the same people with yellow face paint or dressed like that, you know, yeah, with some sort of very color. And there's a lot of that stuff that's shown, but someone going to work, you know, I was in the island of Tonga, and I remember being in the capital, and people would dress for work, just like, you know, people anywhere would dress for work. The one difference was that men would wear a grass-woven mat around themselves, almost as if it were a skirt. Huh. And they would wear this over, say, a business suit. And this was the equivalent to them of wearing a tie.
Wow.
And I thought that was really interesting. And it's not, I mean, you had both modern dress, but they had a, you know, a traditional twist to it as well. And I think you'll see that in a lot of places where just, you know, the average dress that people have may only be, you know, maybe normal Western clothing, but maybe they'll do something special on occasion.
How do you approach people? I mean, just for my own, I guess, selfish, I'm just curious. You know, when you're out there and you see people going about their daily lives, do you walk up to them and say, hey, can I snap your photo? Or do you just take it and run? What do you do?
It depends. So what I found is that almost everywhere in the world, children love to have their picture taken. So a good, when I was in Sierra Leone, we spent one day on this beach and there were these kids. And even though Sierra Leone speaks English and it's a former British colony, English isn't necessarily the first language of everybody there. So these kids were on the beach and there was this one tree with a really low hanging branch. And they wanted me to like lift them up and put them on the tree branch. So I'd do this, and then they would jump off the tree branch again. And then they'd say, do it again, do it again. So eventually they were doing this, and then they saw I had a camera, and they started saying, snappy, snappy, which is what they call pictures. So I took pictures of the kids, and this is after playing with them for like 10 minutes or so. There are other places as well. On the same trip, we went to a place in Benin, which is, it's a, how to describe it? It's a village that's on stilts in the middle of a lake. So Benin, Togo, Ghana, this was a big place for the slave trade, like in the 18th century. Mm. And so people fled and created this village in the middle of a lake on stilts in order to escape the slavers. And the village still exists in the middle of the lake on these stilts.
Wow.
But when you visit this place, the people there, more than any other place I've been in the world, do not like having their picture taken at all.
Huh.
They would put their hands in front of their face. They didn't like it. And I didn't know if it was something special, cultural, you know, some tradition or belief they had.
Yeah.
Or if it was the fact that Benin doesn't get a lot of tourism to begin with, but what tourism they do get, they all tend to go to this one village. And I don't think that it's like most tourist villages where everybody is kind of involved in the tourist trade at some point. Either you're running a hotel or a restaurant or a cab service or something. Most of the people here were not part of it. They would fish. They would do whatever they would do if tourists weren't there. And so they weren't benefiting from it. So I think they kind of saw the tourists as an annoyance.
Hmm.
So.
Could be. Okay.
So it really depends on how, you know, and sometimes you could be far. A good example, I was on the island of Dominica 2 years ago, and they have this waterfall, and I was maybe 100 yards away from the waterfall, and it's a big waterfall, and there were these women on the rocks at the base of a waterfall, and for some reason, I do not know why, one of the women stands up perfectly centered in front of the waterfall, raises her arms, is in some sort of victory position, and I'm like, she's posing for me. This couldn't have been done better. If I had planned this out, if I had asked the woman to do it, she had her back to me, staring up at the waterfall with her arms outstretched for like 5 seconds.
Oh.
I got the photo, and then she sat back down, and it was just right place, right time.
Don't you love it when that happens?
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, you're making these photos public. So do you ever have anyone sign any kind of release, like a model release, or how does that work?
No, I haven't really. Like I said, given my business model, I'm not really selling these photos.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not using it for a commercial shoot or anything. So most of these are freely available. So they're not technically commercial. I think going forward, if I did more commercial or more assignment work, I'd probably have to start doing that. But it's something I just haven't been doing a lot of as of late.
Okay. And now tell us, what is one thing you wish you knew before you went professional with your photography?
I would say, to starters, I'm not a professional like other people are professionals, if that makes sense. Because I'm not doing assignment work and I'm not selling my photos, per se.
Mm-hmm.
So my business is different. But I would say the importance of the business end of things. That really is, you know, and I think that's where most photographers fail. And, you know, I'd say also the importance of gear, but that's something I never really bought into that much anyhow. Or that, you know, you only need a certain amount of gear, and everything beyond that is simply the travel.
And you know, you said that you don't consider yourself, I guess, a traditional professional, but yet your lifestyle, I mean, to me, it looks successful. And that depends on every person's individual definition of success.
Oh, I'm making money. and I'm winning, you know, I've been named Travel Photographer of the Year by two different, you know, national organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, by those metrics, yeah, I'm doing well. It's just that the money is not coming from traditional sources.
Excellent. Okay. Well, now, next, tell us, is there a particular photography resource, tool, online course, book, software that you would recommend to our listeners who are specifically interested in travel photography?
I can tell you about one that's going to be launching soon. It's called the Travel Photography Academy.
Ooh.
And it's being run by me. And we hope to launch it later this summer. I just got back. We spent 2 weeks in Spain and France shooting for this course. So it's going to be a course that's going to go through not only the basics of photography, and you can find that pretty much anywhere, but we're also going to get into a lot of the things that you only really know when you're on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So like how to handle and edit your photos when you're living out of a hotel. And we're going to be talking to great photographers. We're going to be doing specific destination type instruction. So like, here's what to do when you're in Paris. Here's what to do if you're in New York. You know, here's what to do if you're in Tokyo. Sites to see. You know, a lot of people, they want to get the iconic images, and that's fine. You know, the Eiffel Tower. But then, what is beyond that? What should we be looking for and capturing beyond the obvious iconic shots? So it'll be a course. Once you pay for it, you get a lifetime subscription, and there'll be opportunities for workshops and tours and everything beyond that. And, you know, the reason I'm doing this is because I have seen so many people, so many, who have dumped a lot of money in their cameras. I mean, I see people with $10,000 worth of camera equipment on trips that cost thousands of dollars, and they're shooting, you know, they're taking horrible photos. Because they're shooting in, you know, full automatic, they're not shooting in RAW, they're not editing their photos, they're not composing stuff right, and they're trying to take, you know, the ultimate selfie, really. And they're not even doing a good job with that. So the goal is basically, if you're going to spend all this money on gear, and you're going to spend all this money on a trip, then take the time and learn a little bit about your gear and how to make the most of your trip and your photography.
And give us that name one more time, the travel...
It's at travelphotographyacademy.com. And right now you can sign up for the emailing list, so we'll notify you when it's ready to launch. And I'm hoping it will launch sometime later this summer or early fall.
That sounds awesome. Travelphotographyacademy.com. How exciting. Keep me updated on that.
I definitely will.
Excellent. Well, this brings us to our final question, but definitely the most important. Tell us where we can find you as far as your website and any other accounts that you want to mention.
You can find me at everything-everywhere.com, and from there you can find all my various social platforms. The one I enjoy the most is Instagram right now, and on Instagram I'm just everything everywhere.
Awesome. That is just awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us, Gary. You're such an inspiration.
Well, thanks for having me on. I always love doing it.
Are you getting ready for your first photo shoot and need to learn some common mistakes to avoid? Or maybe you need to learn how to communicate with your clients and grow your business through email marketing. Or perhaps you're just getting started with your website and you're trying to figure out this WordPress hosting stuff. When you're in business for yourself, it's a lifelong learning process for sure. And that's why I've set up the Pro Photographer Journey Resource Center. You can learn all of this and more through my free and paid self-paced online courses. Each course focuses on these individual topics and is designed to hold your hand every step of the way and help you learn how to run your business more successfully. You'll also find a host of other tools in the Resource Center that are useful for running your photography business, many of which I use myself. From email marketing tools to forming an LLC for your business to cool image editing software, it's there. And wherever possible, I include coupon codes to these online services so that you can grab a discount. So check it out at prophotographerjourney.com/resource center. That's prophotographerjourney.com/resource center.